Palestinian Authority describes as immoral and political blackmail Israel's offer of COVID-19 vaccines to some countries in exchange for political concessions. The Armenian Prime Minister fires the head of the General Staff of the country's armed forces after the military calls for his resignation. And the daughter of Dubai's ruler, who was found barricaded by her father, urges British police to reopen an investigation into her sister's kidnapping in the year 2000. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafieh. Good to have you with us. Our top story, the Palestinian Authority has called immoral Tel Aviv's offer of COVID-19 vaccines to a number of countries in exchange for political concessions. Palestinian Foreign Affairs Minister Riyad al-Maliki slammed the move as political blackmail and promised to expose Israel's intentions. Maliki says that the offer is intended to exploit the humanitarian needs of those countries. Israel's list of vaccine recipient nations includes several states that have pledged to move their embassies to Jerusalem or Quds, and the African states that recently normalized ties with the regime. And this while Israel has blocked the transfer of more than 2,000 doses of vaccines to the besieged Gaza Strip. The United States has announced in its bid to rejoin the United Nations Human Rights Council and seek an election for its panel for the 22-24 term. Washington's return to the Geneva-based council is aimed at eliminating the focus on its ally, Israel. Now, doesn't this draw the immediate conclusion that Israel is guilty of breaking international law, especially in the occupied territories, that it needs U.S. shielding?
The Israeli regime is infamous for breaking a long list of international laws, which has drawn worldwide condemnation. Back in 2020, the United Nations General Assembly condemned Israel the most, as it adopted 17 resolutions against Tel Aviv's violation of international laws. That's almost three times more compared with the rest of the world combined, standing at six. The Gaza Strip has been subjected to the longest blockade in modern history. In 2007, Israel imposed a land, sea, and air blockade on Gaza. The inhumane blockade severely restricts imports and exports, people's movements in and out of Gaza, and access to agricultural land and fishing waters, denying Palestinians of their basic human rights. All of these actions are against international law. Israel also demolishes the homes of Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem al-Quds and elsewhere in the West Bank in order to provide land for building illegal settlements. According to the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2334, settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds are a flagrant violation under international law. Adding to that, Israel frequently targets military positions inside the war-hit Syria, hitting more than 500 spots in the year 2020. Moreover, Israeli aircrafts repeatedly violate Lebanon's airspace on a daily basis, which, again, is a clear violation of international law, in this case, Lebanon's sovereignty. The regime is also the only possessor of nuclear warheads in the region. However, it has always refused to accept or deny having nuclear weapons. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency, as it has never allowed inspections of its nuclear facilities and has refrained from joining the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Recently, reports revealed that Tel Aviv was expanding its Dimona nuclear facility, which provides the regime with material needed for its nuclear arsenal. The regime is estimated to have between 100 to 400 atomic warheads. That is why Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program. Meanwhile, it has carried out several assassination operations against Iranian nuclear scientists over the past decade, all in defiance of international law.
Well, we don't really need the U.S. Claims to for us to believe that Israel is breaking international law. It's been doing that ever since it claimed independence 70 years, more than 70 years ago. And it's the worst offender. There's no question that Israel, it's an occupying, it occupies, terrorizes 70 years. No other country, you can think of Myanmar, it was very bad with its Muslims, but not even one-tenth of what Israel does really every day.
Now, Washington's latest bid for the UN Rights Council comes 3 years after former President Donald Trump left the body. It now claims to place human rights at the heart of its decision. Ironically, it has also said that Israel, a human rights violator, is targeted unfairly at the Council and needs to be protected. Now, Tel Aviv's crimes have drawn a strong international condemnation, especially from the United Nations. However, Washington accused the rights body of displaying hostility toward Tel Aviv. Now, how can the U.S. use the human rights card against other countries and at the same time protect one of the worst human rights violators? That's Israel.
Three years after former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration withdrew from the United Nations Human Rights Council, his successor Joe Biden has moved to rejoin the panel for the 2022-24 term. Washington walked away from the council during Trump's term in office in 2018, accusing it of displaying hostility toward Israel. That is why Washington's bid to rejoin the Geneva-based rights body is aimed at eliminating the so-called unfair focus on Israel. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has been widely condemned internationally for its violation of international laws. The occupying regime is routinely on the UN General Assembly's agenda since late 2006 and is condemned for violations, as mentioned, in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Previously, Biden stated his opposition to the expansion of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. He also said the only way to reach peace between Palestine and Israel is a two-state solution. However, his administration's move to shield Israel against international outcry over its crimes somehow contradicts his earlier remarks about Palestine-Israel issue.
Of course, it's undermining the UN. The UN's very weak anyway. It's got really no political clout because it's still ruled by the veto in the Security Council, and any reasonable requests and laws are vetoed. So it doesn't really have any clout now. But it does have these committees, and it does get some kind of press coverage, and it has credibility. People don't see the UN as an evil force.
The Israeli regime's malicious acts are not hidden from the eyes of international human rights bodies. However, Washington's attempt does not only seem unfair, but also undermines the UN Rights Council's credibility. When Israel holds the record for the most broken UN resolutions, the credibility of the UN as a rights body comes into question.
Moving on, the Armenian Prime Minister is calling on the army to obey the people and elected officials. This after the country's top military brass asked him to resign. Addressing his supporters in Yerevan, Nikol Pashinyan said that the question of his resignation could be decided by the people only because he was elected by them. He said that the army must instead focus on its job to protect the borders and territorial integrity. Pashinyan has branded the army's call for his resignation as an attempted coup d'etat. He fired the head of the general staff of the armed forces. The premier is criticized for his handling of last year's conflict with Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. The six-week conflict resulted in ethnic Armenians losing parts of their land. Pashinyan's critics see the loss as a national humiliation. A former lawmaker, Tavan Pagosyan, believes that a political crisis in Armenia must be solved through peaceful negotiations.
Like, we have a hope that finally everything will go with the peaceful negotiation process. But it's still yet on the level of the hope. We hope that finally, when the whole political parties and many other institutions make a call on the way that we need to resolve everything calmly, peacefully, by negotiations, but the first step towards opening this possibility for entering into the room to negotiate should be a resignation of the Prime Minister. If finally the Prime Minister resignation would be there, I think everything will go peacefully. If not, maybe even we would see the be the witnesses of the clashes, which is truly not preferable option.
A U.S.-led coalition is reportedly come under a bomb attack in central Baghdad that happened on a highway in the province of Babylon. The explosion left no casualties but caused material damage to a truck. American forces and their supply convoys have increasingly come under attack in Iraq amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments. following the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Soleimani and Iraqi Commander al-Mohandas last January, the Iraqi parliament passed a resolution urging the government to end the presence of U.S. forces in that country. The daughter of Dubai's ruler, who was found barricaded by her father in the video, had reportedly urged British police to reopen a probe into her sister's kidnapping in 2000. British media says that the 35-year-old Sheikh Latifa, the daughter of Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, had made the requests in a handwritten letter 2 years ago. Cambridgeshire police have confirmed receiving the letter. Latifa's sister, Shamsa, was kidnapped from a street in the city of Cambridge at the age of 18. She has not been seen in public ever since. Latifa herself appeared in deeply troubling videos recently released by the BBC, in which she says she is being held against her will and fears for life. The UN and rights groups have called on Emirati authorities to disclose the princess's condition and whereabouts. The United States says it will soon release an intelligence report on the 2018 murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki made an announcement adding that President Biden is also expected to speak to Saudi King Salman. Khashoggi's murder will reportedly be a hot topic during a phone conversation. The declassified document reportedly implies that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved in the journalist's murder. Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist and a fierce critic of Saudi government policies. He was assassinated by Saudi agents at the country's consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Political commentator William Beeman says that former President Trump concealed the documents regarding the murder of the Saudi journalist.
The Khashoggi murder is a scandal, and it has been hidden by the Trump administration. That is, all of the documentation that was collected was suppressed by the Trump administration, largely because of the personal and, I should say, commercial relationship between Donald Trump and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. Now the Biden administration has come into power, and this documentation will now be unclassified. We're waiting for the documentation to actually be declassified. Avril Haines would be the one to do this, and Ms. Haines has promised to declassify this material as soon as possible. But we know quite a lot about this assassination, and I think that there's general consensus that Mohammed bin Salman was involved in this at some level.
Now, Iran says that the U.S. and European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal must abide by the accord and not ask Tehran to stop its remedial measures foreseen in the agreement. In a tweet, Iran's foreign minister said that Washington's behavior caused Tehran to take steps away from the deal, known as the JCPOA. Mohammad Javad Zarif noted that the European parties to the agreement bear part of the blame as they failed to do business with Tehran for 3 years. Zarif stressed Washington and European countries must remove the grounds that prompted Tehran to scale back on its commitments. The former U.S. administration unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Tehran started gradually reducing its nuclear commitments a year after Washington's pullout. The Iranian human rights attaché in Geneva says that Yemen is facing a dire humanitarian crisis as a result of France's lethal arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Mohammed Sadat Najat says that the United States and Canada, along with France, Germany, and Britain, have a hand in war crimes against the innocent people of Yemen and Palestine. The Iranian official said that the U.S., Canada, France, and Germany have a long history of systematic racism against minorities, and therefore they have no right to preach on human rights. The official was reacting to the Wednesday comments by French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, who voiced concerns about a situation of prisoners with dual citizenship in Iraq. Iran has hosted the International Telecom Exhibition. The annual event brings together ICT firms and startups to present their products and services. Youssef Jalali was there.
After several delays due to the coronavirus, Iran's major ICT event finally opened its doors to tech savvies. The 21st International Exhibition of Telecommunications, Information Technology, and Innovative CIT Solutions is now underway in Tehran. Some 200 Iranian and foreign companies have attended this year's show to showcase their services.
During the coronavirus pandemic, many firms required their staff members to telework. Many others needed to outsource part of their affairs. This is where we stepped in and helped with outsourcing by launching a digital workplace where staff members can handle their assigned tasks online.
We specialize in the production of e-government software, core banking and e-payment. Our ERP or Enterprise Resource Planning software is our recent achievement, which will be exported to other countries.
An interesting part of this expo is this booth, which hosts newbies and gives them a chance to present their inventions.
Hello, I'm Halia Absarfati. These are some of my smart projects about IoT, Internet of Things. For example, smart parking, smart flower pot, and smart trash bin.
A major difference in this year's expo is the strong presence of venture capital funds and accelerators, which occupied a separate hall in the expo. In recent years, an increasing number of sponsoring firms have turned to ICT to support innovative ideas and lead them to the market.
Our innovation center offers acceleration services and shared workspaces for promising startups that are active in the ICT sector, such as smart city, cybersecurity, and blockchains.
Our major focus is on the Internet of Things. We have launched a platform for students who have creative ideas in this field. We listen to them and guide them through their projects and turn their ideas into products.
The ICT sector in Iran has seen a boom in recent years. One major drive behind this growth is the U.S.-led sanctions on Iran's economy. It seems ironic, but in fact, this challenge has prompted local firms to double down on their efforts to compensate for the shortcoming.
As our lives are becoming increasingly intertwined with the zeros and ones, Iranian tech companies here say they're trying to catch up with the fast-growing trend of the ICT sector despite all problems caused by sanctions. They say the potential is there, but government support can catalyze this progress. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Democracy, directed by Swiss filmmaker David Bernard. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is John Rees, who is a writer, broadcaster, and author. Now, Democracy is a documentary that gives you an amazing insight into the legislative process at EU level, offering a compelling story about a handful of politicians trying to protect society in the digital world from the dangers of big data and mass surveillance. And following 2 long years full of pitfalls and accelerated by the upheaval of the Snowden affair, parliamentarian Jan-Philipp Albrecht and European Commissioner Viviane Reding worked together for a new law on the protection of personal data.
people say data is the new oil, the oil of the 21st century. If you think about how oil has transformed our lives, data is going to do the same thing.
Für der Knoten meines Lebens. Wenn ich da als Minister sitzen würde, würde ich auch jemandem zuhören, der keine Krawatte trägt. Es geht darum, dass sie eine Datenschutzverordnung verabschieden sollen.
Data protection is a fundamental right, and the companies have the duty to explain what they do with our data.
European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused.
That causes jobs to leave the European Union.
Our life is about data. Data are money.
Surveillance is about managing populations, managing people.
That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
It is our responsibility to get these rights in place.
Who do you think would like to stop the direct?
Well, I think we know the usual suspects.
Well, first of all, warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary tackles an important issue of our time and gets behind the scenes of the European privacy debate. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on democracy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, fascinating and important subject, but for me, sadly, deeply unpersuasive treatment. I mean, it's by nature, you know, if you're going to follow lots of bureaucratic meetings with people kind of, you know, arguing over very, minutiae of clauses and things like that, there needs to be something to grip an audience. And, you know, first of all, it's filmed in this kind of very kind of nondescript greyish black and white. But I guess the director would say he's probably trying to avoid sensationalism or dumbing down.
Well, some critics have actually praised the film and its efforts and its monochrome sort of sequences and the black and white feel to it, because it is an incredibly tough subject to film and follow through. Perhaps the director made it for new audiences watchable, given it's a tough subject.
I mean, if people get something out of it, that's great. All I can talk to them is my experience of it. And I do think this is an issue that, because it sounds quite boring, people do switch off. And I think unless you're preaching to the converted, if you want more people to be engaged in this issue and you want them to sort of sit up and take notice, you need to get their attention.
Just to bring in John here. John, are we as a society largely ignorant about data protection issues? So surely this film can help persuade people of this argument.
Well, it'd leave people going away with the idea, maybe I must find out what it's about. And also the critical thing you see here is what happens when corporations that are privately assembling data for consumer management, which is one issue, an important issue, flips over into state access to that data. And that's what the Snowden case, of course, revealed. And that's
we're
the only
picking up on that.
Yeah, and that's the only time
when
the film really kicks off.
Ladies and gentlemen, the citizens are very worried. 72% of European citizens are concerned that their personal data may be misused. Our reform will assure a high protection to the individuals. A single set of European rules on data protection, fit for the digital age, valid everywhere across the European Union, on the basis that the personal data belongs to the person.
When I became Commissioner for Justice and responsible for the protection of the citizens, I knew at that moment I had to reform the data protection rules. Without trust, no digital economy. So it is in the own interest of the politicians who want to develop our economy and of the industry who wants to take advantage of the personal data of the individuals, that clear rules are established so that citizens know, all right, I can hand out my data. That is exactly what we need. Because in this new digital world, no service can function without the data. The data are needed.
So So that was the importance of data protection. Lee, what else does this film tell us about the significance of data protection? What arguments does it make, and, you know, why is it so controversial?
Well, I mean, all the arguments that Viviane Reding makes and Jan-Philipp Albrecht, they're all absolutely valid, and they're things that we should be concerned about. But I would question one of the things she says there. She says, without trust, no digital economy. Now, the fact is, a lot of people, as they say, don't trust it, but actually, we all are kind of complicit because we so easily give our consent and agree to things and share our details that actually the digital economy seems to be doing quite well. And the issue is, why are we so pliant, and why do we give our consent so easily? And this is the thing. A film like this, or anything that discusses this, whether it's a news program or a documentary, should be trying to alert us and give concrete examples of what is happening with this data and why we should be more concerned.
Surely this is a testament to the documentary, then. It's just simply following sort of the bureaucratic process and that bringing to light and to this issue to the public eye, whereas we would otherwise not know about these issues.
Well, again, I think its heart is in the right place. It wants to do that. I just don't believe it does. What this does is follow very diligently, and, you know, obviously taking a long time, the trail, you know, the process of getting these laws applied.
So, John, for viewers who haven't seen this documentary, could you help contextualise this issue of data protection? Why is it such a huge issue?
Well, for the first time in history you've got is major corporations being able to track, not by name, and that's important, but in general patterns, consumer behaviour at quite a detailed level. And there's a question mark about whether or not that should be, the degree to which that should be able to be done, and certainly able to be done without consent. And that's an important issue. But, and I have to say, that clip is very revealing, although the filmmaker doesn't make very much of it, because the film is framed as if it's a battle of, you know, kind of libertarians against the power of the corporations. But that's not what the EU does. In fact, what the EU does is it excludes cowboy capitalism so that the really big guys can agree on the rules and compete on that basis. That's what it does for the European area.
So who else can we rely on then to ensure that these checks and balances
well,
are
we're
in
coming,
place?
We're coming to that, because the people who are actually the heroes of this story and the person who ignites this film is Edward Snowden. Mm-hmm. And those are the people who should, you know, Jan-Philipp Albrecht, all right, nice guy, green, trying to do his best, thinks the EU is a marvellous institution, wants the corporations to behave reasonably, fair enough. But that isn't really the person that smashes open this whole debate, even in this film. And he's supposed to be the hero of this film.
Interesting point you make. And we'll touch on Snowden again, as I mentioned, a bit later on. And Lee, if I could just quickly ask you, what were some of the obstacles that Jan faced then in trying his lobbying efforts?
Well, I mean, you know, this basic assumption that citizens are consumers and therefore we should be treated as such. It's like, therefore, you know, what's wrong? We're going to give you what you want. This is a shortcut. If we know, you know, the things that you're interested in and where, you know, what your daily existence is about, we can help facilitate that. Now, obviously, that's a very positive spin on that. The downside is, you know, it's about commerce and it's about selling things to people. And unfortunately, the kind of the positive benefits seem to get easily swept aside in the rush to kind of make sales.
I think everybody is aware that the lobby on this file is one of the most intensive that we've seen for a long time.
This has been the most heavily lobbied piece of legislation in recent years. Why is it causing so much stir and interest?
It is important to understand that European companies are a major part of this growing internet economy. Some of the most successful global internet companies to date are European.
The conflicts between big giant internet companies and the rights of the individual in terms of protecting their data online. What were some of the conflicts, if you could shed more light on that, between these companies and data protection?
Well, I mean, aside from the whole commercial angle, there's the surveillance side of things, and the idea that if, as John was talking about, if the companies share this information with the state, what use is that information going to be put to? So in the UK, you know, famously, the sort of Snoopers Charter that came, you know, was announced November 2016, is maybe hopefully going to be
passed into law last year.
Exactly.
Also known as the Sneakers Charter.
Yeah, exactly. So that whole idea is, if you get someone in charge, I mean, the US is perhaps a good example, who looks like they're cracking down on kind of, you know, freedom of information and things, then maybe that information is going to be misused. And this is a big worry for people. It's like, if you can pinpoint, maybe without specific names, but, you know, being able to identify people by so many characteristics, where's this going to go? And if you're allowing this stage's, you know, gradual sort of erosion, then, you know, it's open to abuse in the future.
And John, so this film implies that giant internet companies such as Google, Microsoft, Facebook, etc., Yahoo, for example, that they have invested interests in data, against data protection. They don't like to be associated with these sorts of laws and things. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, I think every capitalist corporation just wants as much freedom as possible to gather as much information about its customers as possible and use it how it likes without legal regulation, transparency or oversight. I think that's a kind of given, and not just in this industry, by the way, but right across the board. I mean, big corporations are some of the most secretive bodies in our society. I mean, probably only the state secret service agencies are more secretive than giant oil companies or giant car companies, and of course industrial espionage is a thing. So, you know, I think we have to take that as one of the ways in which a competitive profit-seeking system works. That's what they want. That's what they want it to do.
So how can an individual, take on sort of a giant corporation like that?
You can't as an individual. The imbalance in power is too great. That's why they are collective, powerful collective entities. And if you're going to take them on, you need powerful collective entities on your side as well. Mass protest movements, trade union organisation, labour organisations, and different. That's why that kind of.
But why don't we see this then? Do you think there's an ignorance then on the public's part?
No, I do think that, and this film kind of underlined this. Yes, there's massive corporate lobbying going on. I think at one point in the film they say 96% of the lobbying that took place over this piece of legislation was from corporations and their various front organisations. And that's an interesting thing, because that will be happening not just on this bill but on every conceivable piece of Labour legislation that you can think about. I think people are concerned about that. We heard the figures, but you know, there are some things that are a lot closer to home than whether or not Google has got your consumer preferences, your health service, your wages, your welfare provision. These are things that are cutting into people's lives right now and matter about fundamental things in their lives. If huge corporations get your data, perhaps they'll missell you things, perhaps they'll try and sell you things you don't want, and have things about you don't know about, and that's bad. But corporations don't have the power to arrest you, try you, imprison you, deport you. That's what the state can do. And so when the state has these powers, this is a wholly order different threat. And I think we've seen that the reaction to these two things by the public is different as well, because they understand that distinction.
So more sinister issues beneath the surface then.
Edward Snowden revealed that secret surveillance activities went far beyond what anyone thought possible.
Companies like Google, Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft got together with the NSA and provided direct access to the back ends of all communicating systems.
I think that the public is owed an explanation of the motivations behind the people who make these disclosures. That's a fundamentally dangerous thing to democracy.
The Guardian's editor-in-chief testified before Parliament that only a fraction of the leaked files have been revealed.
It's about 1% of what we were given. Only 1% of the information in those files has now gone public.
Yes.
The EU Justice Commissioner has spoken about the leaks from Edward Snowden and says that new legislation must be put in place to protect the privacy of EU citizens.
Anybody who uses digital equipment is put under some form of surveillance. And that seems to me is something which cannot happen without consent. It cannot happen without the consent of populations. So my message to the lawmakers is, please protect us.
What's the strength of this documentary Democracy, I think, is that it gives you an insight into the privacy battle before and after the Snowden revelations. So you sort of see that journey and struggle. Lee, how was the revelations a game changer, and did it make the EU go into more gear and make more progress?
I mean, funnily enough, the appearance of Snowden in the film mirrors his kind of, you know, explosion and effect in real life. It kind of jump starts, makes it personal, gives you a concrete example, and actually helps you understand and get a grip on something else. The impression the film gives is that that gives a new impetus to their fight. It gives something concrete, and they can point to that example of Snowden and say, you see, this is the sort of thing we're talking about. If this can happen in this case, it can also happen in these other cases, and therefore that's why our, you know, this issue is so prevalent. And I, you know, the film at least gives the impression that that helps win the argument that they're putting forward.
So finally, we get to discuss the Snowden revelations now in this part of the show. John, what did you make of the revelations, and was it a game changer for the EU and sort of the battle for privacy?
Yeah, I think Lee's absolutely right about this. I mean, it was a game changer, along with others, Chelsea Manning, WikiLeaks, and so forth and so on. But that's the point, really. These are things that come from the heart of the surveillance state, and they're very, very shocking. And they have a political effect about, you know, this doesn't come out in the film, and it should do, but they're about real things happening, about people losing their lives with illegal operations in Afghanistan and so forth and so on, about the treatment of prisoners by the United States and so forth. These are deeply important issues which did have a political effect, and they're about surveillance by the state. And this film doesn't really acknowledge quite what a big shift this is. It says it's a game changer in terms of their legislation, but we've suddenly moved from a film which is only discussing kind of corporate interest in data collection to the question of the state. And it's not surprising to me that that's where the film really becomes interesting. If this film had been 25 minutes long, the last 25 minutes of what impact did Edward Snowden have on privacy legislation going to the EU, that would have been quite an interesting, and is actually quite an interesting documentary. So yeah, it changes gear, but it changes political focus and doesn't really quite acknowledge that it's doing that or why that might be important.
I just wanted to read an example now of Snowden. One of his revelations was that the NSA and the GCHQ here in the UK have far-reaching powers, particularly this country, that undermines privacy and security, variety of means, so unlocking encryption used to protect emails, for example, banking and medical records. And what's also controversial, which the film mentions, is that, you know, why should the US have the power and jurisdiction to spy on people in Europe? So one of the leaks that Snowden revealed was that an average of 3 million data intercepts per day in France, with peaks of almost 7 million in around 2012 and 2013 occurred. So this is quite, the magnitude is just unsort of believable, really. So, and surely that having the EU in place can help buffer sort of and protect us from sort of the US spying from us.
Yeah, interestingly though, we're never told in the documentary to what degree the law that they're passing actually affects the relations between private corporations and the state, and between individual. I'm not even clear at the end of this whether or not that legislation applies to state bodies or not. Now that would have been an interesting thing to know, and to what degree, and do they avoid them, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's also a whole series of issues about the mistakes that the state system makes, because actually it can't process, it can mass data observe, but to get that down to so-and-so did so-and-so and is guilty of such-and-such is a very hard task, and the state often is misled, and injustices and miscarriages of justice arrive because it can't actually process this degree of raw data.
But so it seems like an illusion of power at this stage, more so than their capacity to follow through.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I did ask you sort of your personal thoughts on your data and how it's being used, did this film make you think and more sort of paranoid in any way, or aware of how your data is being used?
Yeah, I mean, you know, truth be told, I'm so aware of it already. You know, you go onto a social media site, you're getting an advert for something you looked at maybe on a different computer 3 weeks ago, just once. That is alarming to me. I got a new phone, I parked my car, I went off somewhere, like a message came up saying, show me where my car was parked. Now, if someone else got hold of my phone, they would just have immediate access. It's obviously trying to do me a favour. Mm-hmm. Say, here's where your car is. Hopefully I would remember that, and maybe there'd be so you go out on a night and you forget where your car is, and it's a useful thing. But you're just so aware of this sort of network that's operating, and, you know, able to kind of track and log and all this kind of stuff. So I have to say, sadly, this film didn't really do anything about that. And I, you know, I think what John says is very right. This change from corporate to state thing, the state thing is the real worry. I mean, the corporation stuff, definitely, you know, I have issues with. But they almost piggyback on Snowden to give themselves a sort of, you know, third act lift. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily tie in together. But it is also doing a service, because there's nothing about the issues that this film tackles that I would disagree with. It's more just the handling of it and, you know, persuading more people to kind of pay attention. I don't think this film quite does it.
And so, John, just your final thoughts on the film now.
Well, I mean, I'd be interested in a kind of 10-minute sequel, because this piece of legislation passed. We all know that, as Lee's just said, this stuff is still happening to us at an exponentially growing rate. So exactly how effective was, after that long battle, after we've watched all this, how effective really, really was it?
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
Hello and welcome back to the light. You are gravely mistaken if you think online fitness challenges are age-bound. That's because the latest trend on social media is nothing but Japanese fitness crunch. Erika Rischko, 81, cannot wait for the pandemic to come to an end. Nothing can stop her from training either. She has now turned to social media to post videos of her activity. Her post have become viral, receiving hundreds of thousands of likes and followers. She says getting encouraging comments from young people has made her very confident and motivated.
It's super. It's just great. I'm super happy about it. I have never been as confident about myself as I am at the moment. This whole thing really gave me a push. It's just amazing and crazy. Nobody was expecting this. I thought people would watch, but all this attention, crazy.
In many of Erika's videos, she is joined by her family members. The famous grandma says her major goal is to urge people to remain active even during the pandemic.
Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now, Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping over staircases or lifting their guns. The unit, made up of 10 men and 10 women, would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times, it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
Spring is coming and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning scenery across China. Clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the Meiji University is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery among missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and this warm spring.
It's the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white color blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view, as stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
For some people, it may take years to build a morning running habit. However, this very special runner seems very impatient in sticking to its daily running routine. The 2-meter-tall ostrich escaped its dwelling to run alongside vehicles on the streets of Beihai, South China. It even tried to keep up with a car's speed by jogging at a very fast pace. The bird's owner says it opened the gates of the farm it stayed in and escaped. He guided the fugitive bird back to the farm by covering his face with a red cloth. The video of the athlete ostrich went viral after its running was caught on traffic cameras.
Iran has inaugurated the Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition according to health protocols. The event is aimed at injecting fresh energy into the tourism industry, which has been badly affected by COVID-19 over the past year. Saman Kujori reports.
Tehran International Tourism and Handicrafts Exhibition has been inaugurated according to health protocols announced by the National Headquarters for Coronavirus Control and following the necessary coordination with the relevant agencies in this field. According to organizers, visiting the exhibition in person will be controlled. Only a specific number of people are allowed to visit each day. Officials and experts believe Iran will achieve a tourism boom after the coronavirus outbreak, believing its impact would be temporary and short-lived for a country that ranked the third fastest-growing tourism destination in 2019.
Although we were under sanctions and at the same time corona pandemic badly affected tourism industry across the country, we have developed and completed many projects in the country during this period. We are very optimistic about the future of tourism industry in Iran because we believe good days are around the corner. Iran is a historically and culturally rich country with abundant attractions.
According to the latest data, 8 million tourists visited the Islamic Republic during the first 10 months of the past Iranian calendar year. Iran ranks first globally in terms of the number of handicraft cities and villages registered by the World Crafts Council. The number of Iranian craft cities and villages stands at 14, while the second place goes to China, which has only 7 craft cities and villages globally registered.
Handicraft exports from Iran before the coronavirus outbreak reached $146 million in the Persian calendar year, which started in March 2019. Iraq and Persian Gulf littoral countries are among the main target markets for Iranian handicrafts.
Under the 2025 Tourism Vision Plan, the country aims to increase the number of tourist arrivals from 4.8 million in 2014 to 20 million in 2025.
Iran's tourism ministry has proposed travel packages under strict health protocols, with the hope of encouraging people to travel and injecting fresh energy to the tourism industry, especially during the upcoming Nowruz holidays. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Feeling frustrated and stressed out, Brazilians have found a place to vent their anger and fury in the newly opened Rage Room. Inside a warehouse on the outskirts of Sao Paulo, people can freely swing giant hammers at old televisions, computers and printers. Demolishing the machines and shattering glass into tiny pieces helps to release their pent-up feelings. The 42-year-old who opened the business a month ago says he has received a fair number of customers wanting to vent, especially during the pandemic.
I think it was the best moment to be able to set this up here. Related to everything that people are going through, a lot of anxiety, stress. Sometimes people miss work or even work a lot at home. I believe this here is like an escape at the moment.
Wearing protective suits and helmets, participants write issues that bother them on the walls, turning the words into targets of their anger. One might think how much it costs to break all these things up. The Rage Room experience, however, costs just less than $5.
Tens of thousands of flamingos have turned the Indian city of Navi Mumbai pink. Bird lovers gathered near a lake to watch the migrating flamingos. Every year, flamingos migrate to Navi Mumbai between October and March. They go there from northern and western parts of India and sometimes as far away as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. Then they fly out in June. This year and last year, their numbers were much higher. Experts say that is because the lake is cleaner thanks to COVID lockdowns. Well, the world's largest snow maze is once again welcoming visitors in Western Canada, offering them a joyful adventure amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attraction opened in mid-February after being in limbo earlier in the winter due to public health measures and unseasonably warm weather. In addition to the giant maze, there are also snow slides as well as snow buildings and huts with artworks inside so the visitors can enjoy other activities besides getting lost. The massive labyrinth is about 240,000 square feet, twice the size of its record-breaking build in 2019. Designers say the larger layout is a nod to social distancing guidelines.
In 2019, we applied for the title of the world's largest snow maze, which we got in February. And this year, just with COVID and everything, we wanted to make it bigger. And so this year it's about 91% bigger than the world's largest title that we hold now.
The visitors can only have 5 people in their group and masks and face coverings are mandatory. Indoor warming areas are closed and picnic tables are also unavailable due to the pandemic.
Now, after an unprecedented winter storm in some parts of the United States, people in Texas have a rush to rescue sea turtles. So the creatures are not used to chilly weather, so they became cold stunned. This is a condition in which sea turtles remain awake but lose the ability to move. Volunteers have so far saved over 4,700 of them off the southern coast of Texas. The rescued turtles were transferred to a convention center and will be freed after the water becomes warmer.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us and bye-bye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.